Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, a deal signed in Addis Ababa to end the fighting in South Sudan went into effect on Friday.
It's incredibly fragile. In fact, it's probably somewhat ambitious to call it a ceasefire.
And the International Criminal Court in The Hague says the trial of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta will now not be starting on February the 5th. This lawyer believes he knows why.
The delay has been occasioned by the strength of the accused, the inductees, who right from the beginning of this case were in a position to influence evidence coming out of Kenya.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
A ceasefire between the South Sudanese government and the rebels went into effect on Friday evening, 24 hours after it was signed in Addis Ababa. President Salva Kiir said it would help see the country's conflict resolved through dialogue. But the rebels accused the government of attacking their positions on Friday, a charge the government denied. Over the last 5 weeks, thousands of people have been killed and close to 500,000 displaced in South Sudan. There have been allegations of atrocities committed by both sides. Laura Hammond is an analyst with SOAS, the London School of Oriental and African Studies. I asked her how fragile this ceasefire was.
It's incredibly fragile. In fact, it's probably somewhat ambitious to call it a ceasefire. It's really a cessation of hostilities agreement, which is meant just to create some space for a further discussion about how to work forward towards peace. So it's not even fully a peace agreement.
What political steps need to be taken to promote reconciliation?
There's a range of questions surrounding sort of how successful the cessation of hostilities will be. It's been signed between the president, Salva Kiir, and Riek Machar as in leading the opposition, but it's not clear how unified the opposition is, and it seems very likely that not all parties who align themselves with the opposition will actually be happy with the terms of the cessation of hostilities. So there's a need to sort of bring the agreement out to the opposition and try to get everyone to sign up to it, and it has very slim chances of being fully successful.
Does that mean ceasefires being signed at local level?
Probably, yes. Whether it's ceasefires formally being signed or memoranda of understanding or other kinds of less written but more verbal agreements of a common position, that's important. I don't want to say that it's not significant that this has been signed. I think it's very significant, and for the first time in weeks we have a possibility of a chance towards ending the horrible violence and displacement that we've seen. But it's only the beginning of a process, and there's a lot more work to be done.
Do you expect political gestures then to follow on from this cessation of hostilities?
Oh, I would hope so. I mean, I think that both parties now will have to go back to their various constituencies and, in effect, sell the cessation of hostilities agreement to their people. And at the same time, the modalities of how the agreement will be put in place need to be worked out. As I understand it, IGAD will be providing forces to monitor compliance with the cessation of hostilities, but it's not entirely clear from what countries that force will come from and how they'll, in fact, act, given that IGAD, by definition, comes from neighboring countries, each with their own vested interest in what happens in South Sudan. It's a very delicate situation.
What's your assessment of IGAD as a mediator?
Well, I think it's to IGAD's credit that they've been able to bring everyone to the table and to do so relatively quickly. And I know many of the regional leaders have been working tirelessly since the outbreak of hostilities. But it's the nature of the thing that because it's a group of countries in and around the region, it's very difficult for them to work in an impartial way to try to provide an avenue for negotiation for these two parties, given that their borders are all around the area of concern. IGAD in the past has not shown a particular amount of strength, and I think this is a good sign to see. But again, IGAD itself needs quite a lot of strengthening, so we'll see whether this either further strengthens it or actually undermines it.
Laura Hammond from SOAS in London. Of the 500,000 refugees that have been displaced by the fighting, some have sought refuge in UN bases, others have fled to large camps or neighbouring countries. Father Jacob Thelakadan works for a Roman Catholic religious institute in South Sudan, the Salesians of Don Bosco. He's looking after refugees in a converted school in Juba. I asked him if they thought the fighting was now really over. For technical reasons, we are reading his answers in the studio.
The fighting will continue, but people on the ground have to...
They don't believe that the fighting will continue, but people on the ground in South Sudan have to be informed that the ceasefire has been signed. I know that we'll have to wait 3 or 4 days before all the people on the ground are informed. Because you know what has been happening here. It's a conflict. It's a war. And to fully understand what's been signed in Addis Ababa, we'll need more time. Just because somebody has said something there, it won't automatically materialize on the ground. Definitely, things will improve. In fact, in Juba town now, some of the people who went away have come back, like Ugandan traders. They are coming back, so things are improving.
What has life been like for the refugees over the last 5 weeks? What have they been telling you about their experiences?
Some of the people ran away when they heard that fighting was going to happen. They did not wait until the fighting started. Some escaped by boat, some by vehicles that they could get, and others walked. Some people just escaped. We had a boy here who walked and walked about 50 or 60 kilometers. And so many children and women. The doctor who met with these children and women said, "Please, Father, don't feed these people straight away, because these people have not eaten for days." He advised us to give them some soft food for 2 or 3 days. So we had to give them water and porridge for some days, and after that, we gave them solid food.
And then only we had to give them the solid food, no?
Are any of them talking about returning home?
At present, no, because they are waiting for...
At present, no, because they're waiting for their husbands to come back or to hear from their husbands. Some of the women here have already got the news that their husbands are no more. But we're trying to tell them not to believe these unconfirmed stories. Because we cannot be 100% sure that things are like that until we get the official data. Sometimes it can only be a rumor, and sometimes it could be that they've gone into hiding. So they're still hoping to receive some news from their husbands.
Jacob Thelakadan in Juba.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
The International Criminal Court in The Hague has said it is abandoning February the 5th as the starting date for the trial of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. No new date has been set, and prosecutors have said they need more time to strengthen their case. Kenyatta is accused of orchestrating ethnic violence that swept Kenya after elections in 2007, in which about 1,200 people were killed. From Nairobi, James Shimanyula reports.
The delay in trying Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta will enable ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda to get more witnesses to meet the high standard of evidence, bearing in mind that she has already lost 3 important witnesses. One of Kenya's renowned lawyers, Agina Ojwang, is optimistic that despite the delays, the case against Kenyatta will be heard.
The case will proceed once certain things are done. One of them is the current investigation going on. The other one, it may be necessary for the ICC to have the accused persons in custody to assure the witnesses of their safety so that they can go ahead and give evidence.
Agina Ojwang has this explanation for why the trial has been delayed.
The delay has been occasioned by the strength of the accused, the inductees, who right from the beginning of this case were in a position to influence evidence coming out of Kenya.
Since the ICC confirmed the charges facing Kenyatta a year ago, witnesses expected to testify against him have either changed their mind, withdrawn or disappeared mysteriously. Agina Ojwang hints at the reason behind the withdrawal.
Witnesses have withdrawn. This means they are not confident of their security. The witness protection system in Kenya is a security item and a security department that the ultimate head of it is, of course, the president. So people feel insecure to continue being witnesses when there is no cover of their identity. Secondly, quite a number of witnesses have disappeared or have been found dead. So it is a very grave matter. It is grave in that the ICC has to ascertain who has killed its witnesses, who has made its witnesses disappear, and who has intimidated the witnesses to pull out.
Kenyans have expressed mixed reactions on the delay of the Kenyatta case. 19-year-old Faith Kitivo thinks the time has come for the ICC to stop pushing for trying Kenyatta.
I think Kenya is an independent country and we should not take our cases to ICC. We should handle the cases in Kenya.
James Misoga, a businessman aged 62, wants the trial to proceed because, as he puts it, the ICC has ample evidence against Kenyatta.
We are told that there's not enough evidence. And enough evidence is there because there is one person who was banned and his family, about 10 or 11 people, were dead. Even that person only can make the case go through.
That report was compiled by James Shimanyula.
Human rights.
Our human rights report this week takes us to one of the African Great Lakes. In Lake Victoria, stocks of fish have dwindled. This doesn't only mean smaller catches for the fishermen in their boats, it also means less work and money for the women on the shore who gut the fish. Some of the fishermen are taking advantage of this by insisting on sexual favours from the women before they hand over their catch. But what might be a romp on the beach for some is sexual exploitation with the risk of HIV infection for others. One NGO has therefore started a campaign with the cryptic but unforgettable title, No Sex for Fish. John Mara reports.
Here at Nyamwere Beach on the shores of Lake Victoria in Kisumu County, fishermen with their catches are paddling their boats back to the shores after a night out on the lake. The catch comprises a variety of fish like small sardine-like fish known locally as omena, tilapia, Nile perch and lungfish among others. At the beach, a group of women are processing the fish, an activity that involves removing the inner parts and washing and packing them in big baskets for other markets. Most, however, are seen scrambling for landed fish and haggling for prices. Fishing is the biggest activity among communities in the Lake Victoria region and contributes significantly to the national economy. However, fish stocks have dwindled greatly due to a variety of factors that include overfishing, increase in the number of fisher folk and rising demand from fish processing and export factories. The water hyacinth that flows on the lake is also a hindrance to fishing. As a result of the drop in the number of fish, women are often pressured into sex by fishermen who supply the fish in what has come to be known as sex for fish. Fishing leader John Owea, who is known locally as the Beach Management Unit Chairman, explains.
It is this way. A crew is coming from the lake with fish. A woman is coming outside that she wants fish. To lure this woman, a crew will definitely tell the woman, please take this fish for your book, for your body. That this my fish, I have to give it to so-and-so, purposely, for her body. Because getting fish is not easy. Maybe you go today, you don't get fish. Or you get fish that is not enough. So when you come, you find these traders are very many, in fact. So they scramble for this thing. So this one enhances that kind of habit.
The fishermen are sometimes away from their homes and families for months. When they take advantage of women on the beach, many of whom are working because they are widowed or divorced, one result has been a steep rise in HIV cases. The Kenya AIDS Indicator Survey report of 2013 shows that HIV prevalence in this region is the highest in the country, with just over 15% of adults aged between 15 and 64 infected. Although many organizations have tried to intervene, the practice still persists. One organization that does seem to be making headway is the Victoria Institute for Research on Environment and Development, VIRED, a non-governmental organization that, together with a volunteer organization, began a program for women known as No Sex for Fish. Professor Joash Okeyo is the director.
Through this program, which we have now run for about 1 year in 2 beaches very successfully, we have been able to show that women can be able to take care of their own families. They are getting income from this program. They are paying their loans from this program. They are taking their children to school, and they are able also to meet their domestic food needs. And then we expect that because of this, because the women dependency on men based on sexual relationship will be a thing of the past.
One beneficiary of the No Sex for Fish program is Agnes Ouma. She told me how it had helped her.
My name is Agnes Ouma. My group comprises of women who were actually involved in the Sex for Fish affair. However, since we formed this group, we have stopped that because we now have our boats and are now employing fishermen. It helps us pay school fees for our children and has greatly changed our lives.
That report was compiled by John Mara. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, members of the emerging BRICS economies have been defending their forecasts for economic growth, despite the tightening of monetary stimulus in the United States. But BRICS member South Africa said there were still going to be some shifts, but hopefully they wouldn't be shocks. Nigeria, which entertains hopes of becoming a BRICS member one day, was recently heralded as a member of a new group of aspiring economic giants. It's known as MINT, which stands for Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria and Turkey. What do Nigerians think of this? In Abuja, Nonya Ogaji has been finding out.
I am walking into an area full of artisans at the center of Nigeria's capital city, Abuja. A number of artisans are busy going on with their work, making products for home use, like window panes and doors, among others. Stopping at one of the workshops to find out what they produce, welder Mike Ajide tells me what they make.
We normally produce gates, window, signboards, oval and ice block machine, better than the one that they are imported.
According to the World Bank 2012 report, all the BRICS countries have become part of the first 10 countries in the world with the highest gross domestic product, and analysts have predicted that Nigeria could also join the club of first world countries if its resources are fully utilized. Ajide does not know so much about all these, but he believes that with steady power supply and security, Nigeria's economy will surely boom.
Before, we had problem of light, but now there is light, full current. If it continues like this, stable light, energy, to produce many things, in fact, future will be better for us. But without light, we use generator, and not everybody that is doing the type of my work can afford to buy the generator.
There are more than 100 other artisans like Ajide in this neighborhood, specializing in different arts. Abdulwahid Olasoju, a furniture maker, is also confident that his products can compete favorably with such from any part of the world. But Nigeria becoming one of the economic giants? He says Nigeria will have to overcome many challenges before.
We are blessed in this country. Most of us who are not even educated, but what they have upstairs technically, you will be amazed. So because of that, I can as well agree with that prediction. But it depends the level of corruption in the country. If we can bring it to the barest minimum, I can as well begin to smile, knowing fully well that that prediction will certainly come to pass, even before the predicted time. Nigeria will shake the world.
I visited one of the most popular shopping malls here in Abuja, and I tossed the question to people who were passing by on whether they see Nigeria in about 30 years to join the list of the greatest world economies. And here is what they had to say.
That's not possible. I don't just have to follow that. There is less job opportunity in the country. And those that are even working, the money they are receiving is not enough to cater their needs, their family.
For me, it makes a lot of meaning because there are a lot of entrepreneurs coming up and a lot of people are self-employed in this country. I think once uninterrupted power supply, it's workable. Give it like 5 years and then Nigeria will be there.
Former Deputy Governor for Economic Policy of Central Bank of Nigeria, Dr. Obadiah Melafia, is also Chief of Staff of the African Caribbean and Pacific Group of States based in Brussels. Speaking about Jim O'Neill's prediction, he says the man knows what he's talking about.
If you look at the fundamentals of the Nigerian economy, the natural resource endowments, the population, the vigor of its mindset, and, you know, the sheer entrepreneurial drive of its populace, that possibility is very real.
However, Melafia says this job of overseeing that Nigeria becomes one of the world's economic giants should not be left for government alone, but also every Nigerian individual should participate in the governance process.
Nanya Agaji reporting from Abuja.
USA.
And this is where you, the listener and online reader, tell us what you think of the stories we've been covering this past week. Shortly before we went on the air, Isaac Mugabe joined me in the studio.
Thanks indeed, Mark. Well, this week the European Union approved sending soldiers to the Central African Republic after months of sectarian violence and political instability since last year. However, Germany reiterated its support for the plan, but is sticking to its line that it will not send combat troops. Maria Cristina Masnata says, "I think all conflicts should be channeled through diplomacy. The only army to be sent would be the Blue Helmets, to protect civilians from any attacks." And Abubakar Lanle Muhammad in Ghana wrote this: "I think if the EU is really sincere about helping the people of Central Africa, they should assist in restoring democracy, fighting corruption and other pressing societal problems, rather than only sending troops to fight."
Interesting comments there. Isaac, what else do you have for us from the listener's desk this week, apart from conflict?
Well, I have something that could still be conflict, but along economic lines. It's about a story we covered this week concerning poultry exports to Africa, and in particular Ghana. Now, you might not be aware of this, but Ghana imports about 165,000 tons of frozen cheap meat from Brazil, the USA, Europe every year. Meat that nobody in the exporting countries wants to eat.
That's a huge figure, considering the fact that local chicken is probably a lot tastier.
Absolutely. The cheap poultry is said to be demolishing Africa's domestic poultry industry, despite EU plans to stop subsidies for the agricultural poultry industry. We asked whether you think African governments should have higher import duties to prevent cheap products from flooding the market. Stephen Kwabena Somo says, "I think that would be a great start once it is strictly enforced. It's about time the right things are done. It's also high time people started working hard and stopped being lazy by importing cheap produce of low quality." And last but not least, Helis from Algeria says, "Thanks to Africa Link, it's my favorite program. Greetings from Algeria." Oh, thanks indeed, Helis, for the kind words. We'll do our best so you can keep on enjoying the program.
Many thanks, Isaac. And you too can have your say by sending a text message to country code 491609575950, an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, or a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany, and your say returns at the same time next week. Our main stories before we go. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has said the peace deal signed on Thursday would help resolve the country's conflict through dialogue. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has scrapped February the 5th as the start date for the trial of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. We've also been hearing what Nigerians think of forecasts that their country could be a future economic giant, along with Mexico, Indonesia and Turkey. Assumpta Lartis will be here on Monday. Do join her if you can. From me, Mark Caldwell. Bye now.